You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. Welcome to I'm Ready for My Close-Up. I'm Virginie Selavi, editor of Electric Sheep, the magazine for transgressive cinema, which can be found at www.electricsheepmagazine.com. You've just heard Tchaikovsky, a piece called Adagio Lamentoso from the Symphony Pathétique, because today we are talking about the late great British director Ken Russell. This is to coincide with the DVD release of The Devils and the Ken Russell Forever season. And to discuss the flamboyant genius of Mr. Russell, I have with me Mark Pilkington, founder and editor of Strange Tractor Press, Electric Sheep contributor Richard Bancroft, and Electric Sheep editor, assistant editor, Alex Fitch.
Hello. Demoted.
Yes, you've been promoted.
You've been sacked, apparently.
Yeah, apparently so. To start with, I wanted to talk about his reputation in the press. For a long time, he had this reputation as a sort of vulgar, infantile sleaze peddler. And it seems that the reaction of the British press in the 70s was really extreme. Critics called his films obscene, sick, camp, excessive, garish, and that's just to quote a few adjectives. What do you think angered the press so much?
Well, I wonder if it was because he was trying to popularise high culture. And so the typical guardians of that kind of criticism felt that they were being challenged because he wasn't talking about it in highfalutin terms in The Guardian or whatever.
Do you all agree with this?
Yes, up to a point. I think when somebody like Derek Jarman did the same kind of thing, it didn't really raise an eyebrow because he wasn't making films for the same kind of mass audience that Russell was, or perhaps he would have liked to have been, but they weren't going to get that kind of distribution.
And also, Ken was sort of muddying the waters by incorporating highbrow elements into, you know, I don't know if it was lowbrow, but into, like Rich was saying, kind of mass entertainment, and sort of mixing these two worlds, which should be kept separate.
Yeah. And he was clearly very interested in artists and writers and musicians. What do you think of this interest? What do you think drew him to those people? And what do you think of the way he portrayed them?
Well, I think it seems to be a very British thing, because a lot of British filmmakers don't come from film school. They come from art school. And so you get the likes of Ken Russell making films about composers, Derek Jarman making films about the likes of Caravaggio, Peter Greenaway making films about, you know, Rembrandt. It's because there is actually a history of these people engaging with the fine arts on an intellectual level. And so it's natural that that should become the subject of the films as well, I should think.
And also possibly it's because Russell's background wasn't academic. I mean, he hadn't even been to university. So possibly he didn't have drummed into him the sort of excessively respectful view we're supposed to take of people like Tchaikovsky or D.H. Lawrence, and therefore tried to find a way to make them appeal to other people in the way that they'd obviously appealed to him, by just kind of grabbing him very roughly, if you like.
And I guess he was, you know, emerging in the 60s at a time of, you know, sort of cultural sort of, I guess, excess and flamboyance, and it took someone who wasn't perhaps kind of ingrained so traditionally in that culture to actually draw the parallels and be able to see these characters, you know, in the light of the world he was sort of emerging into.
And the tagline of Savage Messiah, his 1970 film about the French sculptor Henri Gaudier-Bresca, is "All art is sex," and there seems to be a very, very strong connection for him between art, sex, and life.
And everything.
Yeah.
Sex with everything. Well, I would suggest that's got a lot to do with his sort of Catholic upbringing, and, you know, and obviously, if not being a Catholic, but so I'm told, if you're a Catholic, you know, you're obsessed with sex.
And I don't know. Yeah. I had a Catholic upbringing.
and I think it was just, you know, he was maybe just came at the material with this sort of extra kind of drive and urgency and anger as well. I think there was clearly a desire to to sort of rile people and stir things up. And I was just reading a great sort of snippet today about him talking to Jarek Jarman before, while they were doing The Devils, and they were actually saying, all right, how are we going to really upset people with this? We really need to think of something. And they decided to blow the heads off peacocks on screen, which they didn't end up doing.
I heard that too.
A bit like Pete Walker, you know, around the same time, they were looking for ways, although working in a different sort of stratum of British cinema, but looking for ways to kind of rile up the press and the media, and perhaps on a pragmatic level to sell tickets.
Do you think that his work got more and more extreme as he reacted more and more against the critics and against the establishment?
It's superficially, yeah. I mean, there's a lot more... Well, there's more naked women in The Devils than any of his others, but in terms of kind of Listomania is obviously the one where he goes furthest over the top by having... you know, having the composer riding around on a 10-foot-long phallus, and there's a lot of nudity in that as well. But by that point, which is about 1975, it doesn't really feel like he's actually transgressing against anything anymore. And it feels like... it feels like he's trying desperately to still be transgressive and not really managing it. I mean, it's a very entertaining film in its own right, but the sort of... I mean, there are kind of scenes of mock rape and which go a bit further than anything he's done before, but don't have anything like the visceral impact of the nun sequences in The Devils, for instance, or Glenda Jackson kind of rolling around drunk and unconscious on the floor of a railway carriage in The Music Lovers, which particularly stays with me.
Yes, that is a great scene.
Do you think he's a victim of his own success then at that point, because there is a cult of Russell that people expect him to do certain things in his movies?
It could be. I mean... He said in his autobiography that David... He sort of hints that David Putnam, who produced it, was kind of maybe pushing him further. I mean, he apparently imposed the soundtrack on him. And so it's possible that he was being encouraged to go that little bit further just because that's... You're Ken Russell, that's what you do. Yeah, on, let's really rustle it up, sort of thing.
And they'd stopped making Carry-On films by that point.
They had just about stopped making Carry-On films by that point.
They had competition from Robin Asquith and actually Pete Walker and people. You know, there was a kind of, you know, a new... not so much underground, but there was a kind of harder, sort of meaner kind of underground, sort of low culture cinema emerging at that time. So his kind of operatic excess was probably starting to look a bit high culture by this time.
Right, let's go back to scenes of nuns. So The Devils. So it's released this month on the 19th of March, and this is why we're having this discussion. But the version that is released is not actually the most complete version that we have. It's the, what's it called, the original UK X-rated version. And that doesn't include the infamous scene of the Rape of Christ. Is that correct, Richard?
Yes, as I understand it. I mean, it's a pretty peculiar decision for Warners to make, because apparently this isn't something that the BFI have decided, who are releasing the DVD. It's apparently something that Warners, which owns the rights to the film, has imposed on them. I'm not completely sure if that's true, but it does seem a bit weird to release a film that is incomplete, because the people who are going to want to buy The Devils, I'd imagine most of them probably know quite a lot about the different versions that exist. The footage has been screened separately on television. I think Ken Russell and Mark Kermode collaborated in creating a more complete edit of the film, which has been shown in sort of selected venues. And it's extremely disappointing, but also genuinely puzzling as to why they've decided not to allow that to see the light of day. I mean, the cynic might suggest that they're going to do what George Lucas always does and say, no, you're not having it, and then 2 years later produce it anyway and make us pay for it all over again. But...
This or do you think it's a scene that they still find really shocking and that they're scared of releasing?
Well, it's been a long time since the blasphemy laws in this country have been challenged, but, you know, I really doubt that priests would be picketing outside HMV with signs saying down with this sort of thing if it was released. You know.
That they'll be queuing up for their copies going, oh, I can't, at last.
But in a way, you could see it as a very religious film, not as a blasphemous film at all, because there is a Father Grandier really represents a true religion, right? I mean, he finds religion. He starts believing, even though he was behaving like someone who really wasn't very religious. Whereas, and he goes against the corrupt official orthodox authorities of religion. So you could see it as a very religious film.
It's about religious gnosis, direct experience, lived experience of spirit against organized kind of bureaucratic, corrupt mafia, mafia religion, which is, what the sort of papal organizations represent in the film.
But of course, it is. I mean, it did really happen, and presumably they were persecuted and executed by the Catholic Church, which does have a problem with coming forward and admitting its mistakes. And it's not a terribly well-known mistake, so perhaps they're still uneasy about it for that reason. Well, I can't imagine that affecting Hollywood studio executives at all.
No, maybe some weird Catholic cabal has taken over Warner Brothers from the inside, and they're not going to let this happen.
Well, it was the power of the Catholic Church in America in the 1930s that created the Hays Code. So maybe there is still some fear of that sort of pressure in America at the moment. And even if it was released uncut in the UK, you can import any film anywhere these days, and so that could be the reason why.
Possibly.
Russell described The Devils as his only political film. Would you agree with that description? Is it a political film?
I'd say it was political. I don't know if it's his only political film, but
which other films would you say?
I haven't seen them all, so I couldn't comment. But it certainly, I'd say The Devils was political for the reasons I was talking about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, that's political. There are. The only other political aspects, bits in his films I can think of are the Nazi bits in films like Listomania or Dance of the Seven Veils, the Richard Strauss thing he made for the BBC. But I'm not sure those really engage with Nazism as a kind of political ideology so much as just use it as an excuse to have people jump around in SS uniforms.
Maybe it's the choice of subject matter then. You know, if there were political aspects to his other films, they were snuck in under the wire in a biopic or a horror movie rather than actually being the very nature of the plot that is being filmed as well.
I'm just trying to think if there's a political subtext to Lair of the White One.
The landed gentry eating, the lower classes.
Eat the poor, yeah. But certainly, I mean, the politics in The Devils are up front and in your face. And sort of sprayed across almost every scene, and quite very caricatured. But I wonder if he was he saw this as reflecting the current the political climate in the UK or elsewhere at the time. I'm not sure if it was literally about the politics of religion and.
He seems to be always against the authorities in whatever guise, because in The Devils it's both political and religious, but in The Music Lovers, you could say the noble lady, for instance, who his patron, or the conventions of his society, the director of the conservatoire, all these people represent a certain authority that he goes against. In Altered States as well, you could say that the scientist goes against the sort of received ideas about how you're going to do science, and he experiments further than that. So there's maybe that's the political aspect of his work.
And I think he saw that himself in that questing, role of kicking against the pricks and.
And that would be why
sticking it to the man, etc.
That would explain his desire to shock all the time.
Yeah, but he was. I think I don't think it would be stretching things to say he saw himself as, in the Oliver Reed role in The Devils, or as William Hurt in Altered States. Or I think
who did he see himself as in Crimes of Passion? Then I wonder.
but this is clearly this kind of heroic. Heroic mythic kind of role. Mm. He's sort of romantic role. He obviously feels a sort of kinship to.
Yeah, and in Altered States, there's again the interest for religion, but in a completely different way. What do you think about what happens with that, with religion in Altered States?
Well, that's the one with the notorious dream sequence with the guy on the cross with like a dozen eyes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the film is all about reverting someone back to their baser instincts, back to their prehistory, tapping into the lizard brain that we all possess, which suggests that humanity has had some kind of awareness of religion ever since we were sort of drawing bisons in caves, because whenever there is something scientific going on that the human brain can't, you know, conceive of, like even the sun coming up in the morning, it attributes some kind of supernatural reason behind it. And so even if you're doing something about anthropology, then religion will come into it inevitably, because humanity has already strived for some kind of godlike meaning in their lives.
Or maybe this is just something Russell can't extract from his genetic makeup. He's just accepting that for him personally it's just hardwired. But again, also states that I'd say you can compare to the devils again as a sort of in the sort of Gnostic kind of hero sort of, you know, role, where again it's trying to get down to direct the purest experience of, you know, of whatever in older states it's of the cosmos or of you know, of the human genome. And then the devils, again, it's sort of God or spirit or whatever. So again, I guess there's parallels. Then you could see the scientific orthodoxy again as sort of compared to the sort of Catholic hierarchy in the devils. So.
Yeah, and this is as close to a commercial film as he made, right? And as Hollywood a film he made.
Yes, although I think Tommy was the most financially successful film he made. I mean, that would have been more commercial in the mid-70s, because I think The Who were just massively popular. And, of course, he filled it with all kinds of, like, Tina Turner and Elton John and Eric Clapton and all people like that. But then, I mean, I don't know exactly what made Ken Russell choose that particular subject. But, again, it does have, you know, the main character does have his peculiar religious conversion. And the disaster falls when he tries to convey that to other people and get them to copy it. So maybe, you know, maybe for Russell, spirituality is something that can only be experienced by the individual within themselves, and it's only when they start trying to spread it around that the disaster falls.
And it's a film that, in your piece on Listomania, it's a film that you saw as a sort of almost penance to pay after making Listomania. I mean,
it's the other way around. He made Listomania just afterwards, because I think they figured that if you've done it with Tommy, you can do it again with Listomania. I think the penance part was that he didn't really want to make that type of film about Liszt, it seems. And although he says in the commentary that he recorded that it was that he was happy with it, but he was that was kind of forced on him because he'd suddenly become the Tommy guy. And when you've made a stack of money on Tommy and your previous films have been, I guess, Mahler and Savage Messiah, which probably haven't made much money, then you're going to be expected to cast Roger Daltrey and do all the sort of weird disco-y type stuff and have Charlie Chaplin sequences and everything, which, you know, I personally love about Listomania, but I can quite understand why a lot of people don't.
What do you think of the silly aspect of his films and of his sense of humour?
I love it, personally. It's a bit odd when you get... It's slightly strange in The Devils towards the end, where you have sequences that are overtly comic, like when they're examining the vomit they've extracted from some nun and they find a carrot in it, while it's being combined with scenes of really quite intense and unpleasant torture. But I guess that's just... I'm not quite sure what effect he was trying to achieve with that. But when you've got something that's a lot more overtly comic, like large sections of Tommy and Listomania, I quite buy into it, even though it's, you know, very self-indulgent.
It's so absurd and out there that it becomes almost sort of psychedelic, like the dream scene in Lair of the White Worm on the aeroplane. I'm just reminded of that watching it the other night, and just out of nowhere you just have this absolutely Benny Hill kind of sequence of
it's like Cinzano
and
advert.
Catherine Oxenberg kind of leg wrestling in stewardess costumes, you know, while the parents are kind of paralyzed and drooling in the corner, and Hugh Grant's getting a big erection, and, you know, it's just it just comes out of nowhere. It's just brilliant. It is brilliant. Just suddenly, it's like your sort of brain is suddenly flushed of all.
But it's so random. You wonder if it's the sort of thing that came about through happenstance that someone rang him up and said, oh, we've got the set of the interior of a plane for a day. Do you want to use it? Because that makes no sense otherwise.
You know? But I just think it fits totally the tone of the humour in his other films. And also what I like with the humour is the sort of intertextuality. So you have, like, in Lair of the White Worm, there's Oscar Wilde gags, there's the Rosebud gag, you know, that just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You have same thing in The Devils, you have the, you know, sort of sudden sort of anachronistic sort of references to culture from the 20th century, you know, all sorts of just things. He just seems like he just doesn't care.
Well, maybe that's what disturbed the critics so much, that at the same time he's very interested in serious artistic stuff, and at the same time he's very irreverent about everything that you're supposed to respect.
Yeah, I think that's it. That's probably what upset people like Alexander Walker so much. It's like probably just confusing. It was too too modern. But it does also makes him a very, you know, in a different way to say, you know, Goddard or whoever, makes him a very postmodern filmmaker, you know, and one of the really British sort of postmodern.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say it's very British, the black humour. I mean, it's in sort of the cinematic vision of Monty Python that you'll go to some sort of serious historical or philosophical source, but then you'll completely treat it irreverently.
And maybe one problem is that you never then really get pulled into the film, into the plot, because you're always yanked out by these weird gags or sort of things that throw you off the sort of emotional kind of path. And so maybe that's why you always feel like you're kind of watching his stuff almost like on a stage. I mean, we were saying after White Worm that's like going to the pantomime or something, and you're really aware of the acting as well at all times. Everything's very, you know, the actors are always present in their roles. You know, but they never disappear into the film.
But I mean, there are more than enough films you can watch if you want to get drawn into things on an emotional level. I mean, I always find Ken Russell's less successful when he isn't fooling around. I mean, I think Altered States, apart from the fantasy sequences, is kind of a bit dull compared to, you know, even the Music Lovers. You'd think that Altered States would be a more exciting film than a biopic of Tchaikovsky, but it isn't really.
Right.
And, you know, in the Tchaikovsky biopic, at the point where Tchaikovsky reaches his lowest moment and you'd expect the strings to start swelling, it goes into a ludicrous fantasy sequence set to the 1812 overture. That's kind of the knockabout humour that I love about it. And
well, that seems to be what makes Altered States his most mainstream movie, just because all the performances in it are fairly, you know, conservative, that none of them are hysterical, which you'd find in his other horror movies.
Talking about the hysterical performances, I think this is also connected to the nudity that you have in his films, of which there is a lot of. but it seems that, I mean, people focus on that, the hysteria and the nudity, but rewatching films, I was thinking that it's also a way for him to convey emotions or ideas even in a physical and visual way, that he relies on dialogue very little. And I think that's the striking thing about him, and surely that makes him a really interesting director.
I actually disagree. I mean, from the three of his films I've watched in rapid succession in the last week, which I can tell you is quite has quite an impact. I was amazed at my memories of them was of, you know, flesh and blood and screaming, but actually I was amazed at how much just stagey, talky dialogue in The Devils, in Gothic, and Lair of the White Worm.
Okay.
You know, everything grinds to a halt for long periods for people to...
I'm thinking,
you know,
of The Music Lovers, which is very... The whole opening sequence has no dialogue at all. And then the train sequence that you were talking about, you have all the problems that they're having.
You know, you can see exactly what he's getting at.
Wordless scene, which is really extraordinary.
Maybe because that's a film about music, which is obviously you know, more of a direct... Again, going back to that Gnosis thing, just direct-received experience.
What do you think of the nudity in his films? Do you think it's just, like, shamelessly exploitative, or is there something else going on?
I suspect it became shamelessly exploitative around Listomania, or wanted to be. I think early on, though, it's... I mean, it was genuinely boundary-breaking, wasn't it? I mean, the reason Ken Russell is known as a director who has a lot of nudity is because of Oliver Reed and Alan Bates wrestling in Women in Love, and because of the naked nuns in The Devils, and because probably of Glenda Jackson in The Music Lovers. But I don't think I mean, I think for the time, women in love and music lovers must have been shocking. But now, not so much. I think the music lovers got a 15 certificate, didn't it, when they put it out on DVD? Mm-hmm. So I don't actually see it as exploitative, maybe just because I've seen so much more exploitative stuff that's come since then, which is... you know, puts Russell to shame, really, in the exploitative nudity front, some of it. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's what I was kind of getting at earlier. I think just after a point, it became part of the Russell shopping list. Mm. It was what he was expected to do, and so he did it.
Okay. That's all we have time for. Thanks to Mark Pilkington, Richard Bancroft and Alex Fitch for being my guests today. You can read Richard's article in defence of Listomania on the Electric Sheep website at electricsheepmagazine.com. The Devils is released on DVD by the BFI on Monday 19th of March, and the Ken Russell Forever season, organised by the people who were behind the Scarlet Forever events last summer, continues with Listomania at Picture House Notting Hill tomorrow. The Devils at the BFI on Monday, and that's the director's cut, and closes with Elgar on Tuesday 20th. For more information, please go to scalaforever.co.uk. We're going to leave you with a piece by Litz called Love Dream from Listomania.